Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
The Keith Richards tuning, which is open G with the low E taken off the guitar. So it's five strings in open G tuning. And that's like the Keith Richards tuning. But apparently the story is that he learned open G from Rye.
Hey everybody, Patrick Foster here. Welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to this second episode of the Rye Cooter Experience. I'm not sure how long this may go on, but I'm loving every minute of it, and I hope the listeners out there are enjoying it too. If you didn't listen to yesterday's episode, I strongly encourage you to go back and do so. It tells a lot about the foundation of Rye Cooter's life. And we left him just as he had left the Magic Band. Captain Beefheart, Don Van Vliet's behavior was a little too out there for Rye, and he decided to move on from that group. But he didn't form his own band, which is a step you might think he would take. He went into doing something else, and that's what you're going to hear us talk about today. Kurt Gallagher, of course, is the guest, and Rye Cooter fanatic, as am I, even though I'm not the guest, I'm the co-host. Kurt's the guest. And I want to say thank you very, very much to Kurt. So why don't we roll the tapes now? We've got them all set up here in the studio. And let's hit play and find out just what Rye Cooter was up to when he left the Magic Band. So it's really interesting to me, Kurt. Like, Rye was in the Rising Suns. He was in kind of a hot band. Then he was with Beefheart, who, you know, went on to be this visionary and could have been, you know, they could have been a big band too. They were invited to play at Monterey. And you would almost think to yourself, well, maybe the next step is to Rye to assemble the kind of band he wants, right? And kind of lead that. But that's not really what happened. He sort of just continued to follow some spirit. He kind of meandered around a little bit and doing studio work and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Terry Melcher produced the Rising Suns album with a lot of friction from Columbia, but he, you know, they did work together and they became friends. So Terry Melcher started calling him in for a session work. And through that session work, he met Jack Nitzsche. I looked up the pronunciation. I always thought it was Nitschke, but it's Nietzsche, just like the philosopher. So Jack Nitzsche was really connected with, like, he did work for the Stones, and he did a lot of high profile. Yes. If you look him up, there's a huge rabbit hole to go down there. But he started working with Jack Nitzsche. And there was another producer that he did a lot of work with, Russ Titelman. Uh-huh. And he married Russ Titelman's sister.
Oh, wow.
They're still happily married today.
Wow.
But he started getting session work from those three producers, and he started getting a lot of session work. And his parents didn't really understand show business or what he was doing, and they asked him to go to college. So he said he would do it because they really wanted him to do it. So he enrolled in Reed College up in Portland. Mm-hmm. And he was going to college. I don't know what he was studying, but he was going to college, but he missed a week because he was down in LA doing sessions. Ah. And his advisor called him into his office and he said, you know, why are you missing so much school? And he said, well, I play guitar and I was down in LA playing on some records. And his advisor says, do you get paid for that? And he said, yeah, I was down there for a week and I made $10,000. And the advisor's like chin hit the desk or whatever that expression is. His jaw dropped. And he said, okay, what are you doing here? And he said, well, this was my parents' idea. And then after that little encounter with his advisor, he dropped out of school and went back to LA to do more sessions.
Sometimes the college counselor can give you good advice.
Oh, hilarious. Nice.
So there's an incredible amount of
people recording sessions at this time, and he played with, well, immediately comes to my mind is he played on the original version of Willin' by Little Feat, which to me is like one of the great slide guitar, you know, guitar performances you could have, man. It's just amazing.
I've been warped by the rain, driven by the snow, I'm drunk and dirty, don't you know, and I'm still, oh, I'm still. Walk out on the road late at night, I see my pretty Alice in every headlight, Alice, Alice, Alice. I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari, to Hatchby to Tonopah, driven every kind of rig that's ever been made. And I've driven the back road so I won't get weighed. And if you give me weed, whites, and wine, then you show me a sign, I'll be willing to be moving. Now, smuggled some smokes from folks in Mexico, baked by the sun almost every time I go to Mexico. And I'm willing. And I've been kicked by the wind, robbed by the sleet, had my head stoved in, but I'm still on my feet and I'm willing. Oh, I'm willing. And I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari, to Hatchby to Tonopah.
Yeah, Lowell George is also a good slide player and a great guitar yeah. player, but he hurt his hand. Similarly, he was fixing a model airplane
and
with a screwdriver, not a knife, but he managed to injure his hand and he couldn't play slide on that first album. Well, he did play a little bit. He sat out a couple songs, and one of the songs he sat out on was Willin'. He sang it. And I think he might have played the acoustic, but he didn't play the slide. Rye plays the slide on the first recording of Willin', which is amazing. One of the greatest songs.
Yeah, it totally is. Yeah.
And he played, they also did a Howlin' Wolf tribute, 40/40 Blues, mm-hmm. and How Many More Years? And that's also on that first Little Feat album, and Rye does the slide on that. And it's a real hardcore, like Chicago Blues, Howlin' Wolf song medley. So yeah, Rye was on first Little Feat album. Amazing.
It is amazing, yeah. He also played with the Everly Brothers, which is kind of incredible.
Revere and the Raiders. He did a lot of stuff for Paul Revere and the Raiders. They were sort of like the Beach Boys. They had a studio band and a live band two different entities.
Yeah.
The live band would be out touring and the studio band would be home making records. And Rye was in, he did a bunch of sessions with their studio band. They were huge Very back cool. then. They sort of yeah. disappeared in the 70s, but they were huge in the late 60s.
They really were. And they don't, you know, you don't necessarily hear much talk about them, but they were extremely popular and made some very cool records back then, too. Which kind of leads us to another point. And it's kind of like I said at the beginning, I think if you ask people about Rye Cooter, there may be certain things they know, but it's kind of an all-encompassing story that we're trying to put together. But a lot of people would say, oh, Rye Cooter, I know him. He was going to join the Stones, and he met the Stones, and there's a rumor that you know, Mick and Keith stole a song from him and all this stuff. So how did this all take place? How did he come into the Stones orbit at the time that he did?
Well, they knew about him because they came to see Rising Suns at the Ash Grove.
Okay.
But then through Jack Nitzsche, he was working on the performance soundtrack. Jack Nitzsche was producing the performance soundtrack. And they brought Rye in for sessions to play that. But they also, he brought him into some other Rolling Stones, like just to relax, like jam sessions. Because I think he wanted Keith to learn more about American blues guitar. And Keith, he did want to learn from Rye because he saw him at the Ash Grove. And there was stuff that Rye was doing that he didn't know how to do. So the legend is that he learned about the open G tuning from Rye Cooter.
Yeah.
And Keith is famous. You can say to another guitar player, do you know about the Keith Richards tuning, which is open G with the low E taken off the guitar? So
yep.
It's five strings in open G tuning. And that's like the Keith Richards tuning. But
yep.
Apparently the story is that he learned open G from Rye after seeing him at the Ash Grove in one of these impromptu jam sessions that Jack Nitzsche set up. No one knows the true story, but there are rumors that Rye played exactly what you hear on Honky Tonk Women at some of these jams. And the Stones used to record everything. They recorded everything, even if it was just a relaxed, you know, jam session. Someone was recording it, so they had Rye was just showing him stuff in open G, and people think that. Everything you hear on Honky Tonk Woman came from that, you know, jam session where Rye was showing Keith open G. And I think there's a lot of stories about why Rye did or didn't become part of the Rolling Stones. Obviously, Brian Jones was incapacitated from all the drugs and everything. And they were, I think he was already kicked out of the band, but he was still alive. But so they were going to be looking for another guitar player.
Right.
And they knew about Rye, but I think Keith, I don't know if he was jealous of Rye or envious of Rye. I don't really know. But also there was a story about during when they were making the movie Performance, Mick Jagger was doing scenes with Anita Pallenberg, which was Keith's girlfriend. And they were doing love scenes, and Keith was really upset about that. So he would leave some of these practice sessions, and he would just leave and go away because he was so worked up over this stuff with Mick and Anita Pallenberg. So he left one session, and the guys in the Stones and Nicky Hopkins just sat around jamming for 2 hours, and they recorded it, and it turned into an album years later.
Yeah, that's amazing too. I always heard that Keith and Mick didn't want to hire an American, that they wanted an Englishman to be in the Stones, and that's probably as possible also, so I'm not sure. Yeah,
it's mysterious. No one knows, and that makes a lot of sense. I don't think he would have been a good fit. I don't think he would have been a good fit, and that totally makes sense. I can see that 100%.
Yeah.
But there's rumors out there, and there's stories out there. If you want to dig around, you can find them.
There's plenty of them, that's for sure. And it's interesting, I always get the feeling with Rye Cooter that there's something about him that wouldn't have wanted to be in the Stones because he, for whatever reason, you know, that first vibration he heard when he was first had a guitar on his chest. I love that image so much that he always seemed to be following something like that. And it was always that road less traveled that he ended up going down. It wasn't.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been a happy person playing on these big arena tours with the Stones and dealing with all their, I don't know what, you know, how he considered their lifestyle, but it certainly would have been something he would have fit into. So, yeah, probably worked out best for all parties concerned.
Yeah, he would have been boxed in because he wanted to be free to explore island music. We're going to talk about island music soon.
Yeah.
And Tex-Mex. And he would have been boxed in as a member of the Stones. And it wouldn't have worked out for him.
Yeah. So that kind of brings us to the end of near the end of the decade anyway, the 60s, and what he had gone through just in that period of the 60s is enough to make a musical career for a lot of people, but it's only kind of scratching the surface for Rod Cooter.
Tone on a hot and dusty night. We were eating eggs and Sammy's when the black man there drew his knife. Oh, you drowned that Jew in Rampton as he washed his sleeveless shirt. You know, that Spanish-speaking gentleman, the one that we all call Kurt. Come now, gentlemen, I know there's some mistake. How forgetful I'm becoming now, you fixed your business straight. I remember you in Hemlock Road, 1956. You're a faggy little leather boy with a smaller piece of stick. Well, you're a lashing, smashing hunger man. Your sweat shines sweet and strong. Your organ's working perfectly, but there's a part that's not screwed on. I want you at the Coke convention back in 1965. You're the meth bread grapes.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and thank you, Kurt Gallagher, very, very much. That is basically bringing Rod Cooter up to the end of the 60s, maybe with a little peek into the 70s. But what's going to happen next is going to be Rye embarking on his solo career, where he truly begins to find his individual voice. And I think that is going to make some fascinating listening starting on tomorrow's episode. So I want to thank Kurt Gallagher once again very, very much for all his insights, knowledge, and enthusiasm. And I want to play out today with a piece of music that we didn't actually discuss in this episode, though it was in our show notes. And it is the debut album by the band Crazy Horse, the debut they made solo. This was a record that was produced by Jack Nitzsche and Bruce Botnick. And Rye Cooter plays slide guitar on several tracks on this record. And as we've heard in today's episode, he was an outstanding slide guitar player and sat in on a lot of session records doing just that. But this record came out in the very early 1970s. It was on the Reprise label, which we'll hear more about tomorrow. And it is called Dirty Dirty. It was written by Danny Whitten, the late, great Danny Whitten. Of course, with Billy Talbot and Ralph Molina on the bass and drums. So here we go with a song called Dirty Dirty, Rye Cooter on slide guitar. And with this piece of music, we will talk to you guys tomorrow.
And his advisor says, "Do you get paid for that?" And he said, "Yeah, I was down there for a week and I made $10,000.